Please to Psalm 127. Psalm 127. Next Wednesday night is the 2nd of May. That's the Tuesday. I know it's a busy week with all the things that are going to be going on with school. We haven't had the Lord's Supper in a while here. Is there anything planned for next Wednesday night that would keep a lot of our people away? All right, we're going to have the Lord's Supper next Wednesday night then, okay? Is Leroy here tonight? No, I'll tell him. Beg your pardon? Just exams, okay. All right, get a note to Leroy or have him call about that, okay? All right, Psalm 127. We refer to this verse an awful lot because whenever you have the first baby that is born while you're here at Faith Baptist Church, we give a copy of that to the new parents. Psalm 127:3. Lo, children are inheritance of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is His reward. But that verse occurs in the context of a psalm which has tremendous wisdom for parents. Anybody that has raised children, reared children, whichever word you prefer, survived children, has gotten to the point where their children have somehow grown into civilized adults, you go to them and you say, "How'd you do it?" And if their parents, if the kids are really honoring the Lord, I have yet to hear a parent say anything except this: "It was the Lord. It was the Lord." Now, when they're little, you have all these plans and all these ideas. And we can go to all kinds of verses and say, "Now this is the way to turn them out right." But you know, it's like the, you know the, who the Thistle King was? You know, the guy that wrote the letter, and he told him, he says, "Yeah, you come on down here and I'll show you who's in charge." And he wrote back and he says, "Let not him that puts on the armor boast as him that puts it off." Remember that verse? And of course, what he meant was, it's one thing to get into a battle, it's another thing to walk home alive from that battle. I heard a pastor say one time, "Let not him who is raising teenagers boast as him who has them raised." And brother, that's the truth. Somebody told me here just a while ago that, you know, my children are so spread out that I've got an edge on most of you. My oldest daughter is 21, and John will be 21 this fall, or 20 this fall. And Joe and Dan are, you know, we're kind of like grandparents to them because we've already gone through this once, and, you know, we're really enjoying these little guys. I'll tell you, I wish I had known some of the things when my older children were that age. I wish for their sakes I had. But I don't know how else I could have learned it except to learn it at their expense. There's an awful lot of things. You know, I told you before, I've been going to school on you folks now for about 13 years. I've been going to school on my kids for over 20 years. Now, what do I mean by that? It means I learn from them. You've heard me say this before, and this is so true, that the Lord does not allow us to have children because we have the sense to raise them. He gives us children so we can learn from them how to help them raise theirs. Now, that's true. And another big mistake that young parents make, and that is in raising children to be good children instead of to be good adults. Now, what's wrong with that? I'll tell you what's wrong with it. Unless you can somehow convince that child that you recognize that he does not belong to you and that he is a person that God has entrusted to your care, you will never be able to convince him that he does not belong to himself and that he must commit his life to God. I think one of the biggest, if not the biggest mistake that serious Christian parents make in rearing their children is right there in that area. Convincing children that they belong to us, and you will do what I say because that's what I want. And then when they get big enough to resist that, they'll say, "No, I don't belong to you. I belong to myself." Neither one of those are right. But you see, sometimes we set ourselves up for that kickback that's coming when they get a little older. The way to help them understand that they belong to God is by first you realizing that they belong to God. Now notice this. First verse, "Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." Art, keep that in mind on Saturday. Okay? He's building a house. That's not just talking about building a house, though. The illustration, of course, is of a house, but the concept there, the idea, is of a home. Unless the Lord do anything, but especially in the area of the home, except the Lord build the home, those who are striving to build it are doing so in vain. What does vain mean? Vain does not mean vanity in the sense of love of your own appearance. A lot of people refer to that as being vanity. The reason that's called vanity is because that too is a useless exercise. Absolutely no value in that. And a person who is involved in a vain activity is a person who is engaged in something to no effect because there is no value in it. The person who labors to establish something, to build a house, to build a business, to have a life, who does not do so with the acknowledgement that it is God who does it in vain. You think about it. I mean, you look around you today at what people are trying to do, what people are trying to accomplish. How many of you ever heard this statement? I just can't understand why those boys would do something like that. They come from such fine families. They're from such good neighborhoods. You ever heard that? Yeah, a couple of guys, they steal their dad's Corvette or whatever it is, or his BMW or Mercedes, and they run around town and they tear up a bunch of stuff and do all kinds of wild, crazy things. Go down and vandalize the school. You don't have to look too far beneath the surface to understand what's happening there. As a general rule, those boys who came from well-to-do families were not given the love and affection that can only come through parents giving of themselves. They were given things which were a substitute for parental attention and involvement. And the children were basically saying, here's what I think of things. Here's what I think of the life that you've offered me. They reject it and they throw it away. We cannot guarantee success. Now look, we look at the world and we say, well, you know, worldly parents are trying to buy their children's affection. They give them the designer clothes and they give them all these things and they have cars and they have all this, these possessions. We know better than that. We know that the way that you turn out good children is you don't spend your money on pools and cars and games and vacations and all this kind of thing. You spend your money on Christian schools so that the Christian school teacher can turn out a good child for you. Did you hear what I said? In other words, sometimes Christian people fall into the same trap that lost people do or worldly people do. They end up trying to buy it. They just shop at a different store. Now, whether you're trying to buy something in a package which you can hand to your child, which will turn him into something else, whether you're trying to buy that at a Christian school or whether you're trying to buy it at the mall, you can't buy it. You just can't buy it. It takes time. It takes a long, long time. Both of my grandfathers, you know what I remember about them more than anything else in their lives? Neither one of those men were in a hurry. My dad, bless his heart, was always in a hurry. When they were up here for the seminar that week, I took most of the week off. Most of the week, I was off from work to be with him. And you know what he told me while I was here? Son, if you don't slow down, you're going to have a heart attack. I felt like, yeah, you come here next week. It was, if he'd been in the office today, he'd have had a heart attack. But he slowed down a little bit too. But you know, Dad was always in a hurry. I haven't figured that out yet. I haven't figured out how it is that you have kids at that period of your life when you don't have any time for them. You know? I think I have an idea. It has to do with the way the devil has perverted our society so that that very thing would happen. You see? In other words, the devil's got us all running around in circles so much we can't spend any time with each other. I remember my granddad. Boy, my granddad Johnson. I got some stories I can't tell anybody about Granddad Johnson, but I just laugh here while I'm thinking about him. But he was a good guy. He was funny. And he was never in a hurry. I've told you about him before. He was in control of his home. He's the guy that went to bed at 8:30 every night. He had a little TV, one little TV with a little round picture tube in the top of it up there, you know. And 8:30 would come, he'd get up and shut it off and go to bed. It was in the middle of a program. My dad watched it. Nobody did that at home. My dad, but my granddad did. Boy, he shut it off. He shut the lights out. And he went to bed, and that was the end of it.
And he got up at 5. And he ate breakfast whether anybody else was up or not. And that's just the way he lived. And, you know, if you get too rowdy at the table, he'd go. That's all he'd do. And everything would fall silent. We had no idea what was coming after that, but we didn't want to find out. He was in charge. I figured if my mother and dad obeyed him, I better obey him, you know. But he'd always take us out to shoot the rifle. That's the thing I remember so much about him. We'd get the targets. He'd get the .22, and he'd get those little bullets, you know. We'd get a whole pocket full of them out there. And my grandmother was this little bird-like woman. She was about 90 pounds. She had diabetes, had to take shots twice a day. And boy, she talked, even though she was from Tennessee, she talked like a magpie at 90 miles an hour. And she'd start in on him, Jonah, you're not going to take those boys out to shoot that gun. Now, you're going to just go like that. And the whole time, he was loading up and getting his targets. He would say, no, we're not going out. There we go. And we just going out and shoot the gun. Shoot skeet and all that kind of stuff. It was so much. Oh, we just loved it. So he'd take us hunting. I remember this first squirrel I ever shot. He took me squirrel hunting. I'm going to tell you one of them. We were out there, so he chewed tobacco. I was about 9, 10, I guess. And he was always chewing on this stuff. And I thought, what does that taste like? Now, if I'd asked my dad, you know, hey, Dad, you know, can I have a plug of chaw there? You know, what do you think Dad would have done? No. He would have given me a big lecture, you know, and maybe thrashed me around a little bit, you know. I said to my granddad, can I try that? He got his pocket knife and just cut off a big chunk of it and handed it to me. His method was very effective. I'm telling you. Now, Dad would have given me a lecture, but Granddad gave me the chaw. And I've never touched it since. He had a lot of wisdom. He really did. I didn't challenge him about why he did it, but I remember I shot that squirrel. We took that squirrel home and I ate the whole thing. He cooked it all up for me. He was so proud of me. He's telling everybody about it, you know, and that was something. Then my grandfather Vaughn, he was a railroad engineer for 48 years on the Louisville-Nashville Railroad. And he would work, he'd go out one day, come back the next day, and be off the next day. So whenever we were staying with him, we'd always have a little bit of time with him after he rested up. We didn't bother him while he was resting. He'd make pop guns. You ever make a pop gun? I don't remember what kind of wood you use, but it's got a real soft core in it. And you take a coat hanger, and you go down and pull all that stuff out of there, and then you trim a little stick up, and then you chew up a spitball, you know, and stick it in the end of that thing. And then you put one on the other end, and it would make like an air pressure in there. And, pow, boy, you could shoot that wad of paper, and it would sting and hit your brother with it, you know. And that's what we did. But Granddad would take time, and we'd make things like that, and we'd just do all kinds of things. Granddads, you know, they take time. They take time like dads ought to take time. And boy, I see that to myself. Today we got in from the trip, and I hadn't even seen my children yet. We saw Joseph. We picked him up, and then Daniel came home, and I wanted to see him for a few minutes. I had to run off down to the hospital to be with Marco. And I thought, boy, you know, I got to take a little time with that boy. He came in my office Monday, and he had something in mind he wanted to do, and I was so busy. How do you balance it? Well, you just have to do it. You just have to make time. You just have to make time. I remember so much a story that I read from Dr. Bill Rice, where a bunch of people from some church that wanted him to come candidate or hold a meeting or something, I don't know, a bunch of big wigs from something that were coming to talk to him, and he called and he says, I'm busy right now. I won't be able to meet with you for about an hour. They said, well, we're in town. Could we come over? He said, well, okay, but now I want you to understand that I won't be able to meet with you for about an hour. I've got another engagement here. I've got another commitment or appointment. He called. He's got another appointment, and I won't be able to see you for just a few minutes. And so they said, well, that'll be okay. So they showed up about 20 minutes before they said they would. Well, Dr. Rice was down on his hands and knees in the living room of his house. He had an old set of deer antlers strapped to his head and a saddle on his back, and his boys were riding him around the house. And he got up and he said, how do y'all do? Y'all can wait right in here. And he got right back down on his knees and he played with his boys for 15 more minutes before he met with those people. That's one of the reasons he turned out the boys he did too. And you know, folks, it's been hard for me to do that. You know who would get, you know who'd be waiting in my living room if I did that? You would. You know who'd be waiting on the other line? You would. That's been hard for me to do. But I'll tell you, I wish I'd done more of that with my older boy. I really do. And I don't plan to miss my two younger boys' childhood. So if you have to wait, and if I've got another appointment, you understand. Say, well, what am I going to do with my time? Well, go play with your own kids.
Okay?
All right? All right. But remember, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain to build it. You see, the problem is, the reason that most folks, me too, think that we have got to have somebody right now to help us with our problem is because we're not trusting the Lord anyway. We've been trusting ourselves all along, and we've got to the end of our rope, and now we've got to go get somebody else to bring a little more weight into this thing so that we can really keep it under control. Now you see, if you can realize that the Lord is the one that's doing it, I don't know that the Lord is evidently not in a hurry. I've been watching some of the things He's been doing, and He's really not in a hurry in some of the things He's doing. You see? He's been working on a few things here for thousands of years, and He's not in a real big hurry about things. Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain. Now, I can't control everything my children do. I can't. I can't make them obey me when they're not around me. I can't make them not do wrong. But one thing I dedicated myself to a long time ago is if they're thinking about me and they're doing wrong, they're sure not going to enjoy it. And I think that's about as far as we can get in some cases. In other words, if they make up their minds they're going to do wrong, and they're not where you can keep a hand on them, you're not going to be able to prevent them from doing wrong. But you can sure make them keep looking over their shoulder. You see? My dad did. He really did. Dad was strict. I was thinking about something today, thinking about the character that my father has. My dad was an educator. He had two master's degrees, and he was principal of several schools. He had an opportunity to get promoted to the superintendency of one school system in northern Kentucky. He went and he interviewed for the job, he signed a contract, and he moved to the town. And we were all going to move into this one big house there. And Dad was having a final meeting with the folks there. And he said, now, this my dad's a Methodist preacher, you understand that, but we had standards. And Dad said, now, I won't be coming to any of the school dances, nor will I be sponsoring them, because I have a conviction against that. Dancing. Okay? When's the last time you heard a sermon on that? I haven't preached on it in a while. And they said, oh, well, that'll be one of your responsibilities. And Dad said, well, I'm sorry. He said, well, I'll have to find somebody else to take care of that. He said, but, you know, we'll make sure that the kids are safe. He said, but I personally won't be able to participate. And they made an issue out of it. And they said, well, yes, you will. And Dad said, excuse me, but no, I won't. Well, we'll get another man. We'll break the contract. And he handed it over. And Dad took a serious cut in pay and went out and principled some little old podunk school out in the sticks and kept us there where I could finish school at that school. And I respect that. I really do. It's character. Stand for what you believe in. But even though you stand for what you believe in, you've still got to make it a matter of prayer. You can't be the FBI for your children. Now, you know, the Lord has given me an uncanny ability to catch them. Has He you? Do you have that uncanny ability? I remember one time, Daniel Wayne. He never has been able to get away with anything. His mother called him down. He'd gone across the street. Wasn't supposed to cross the street without permission. She went out there and she said, now, Daniel, come back here. Now, Daniel, you know you're not supposed to do that. And he was standing, oh, boy, he was just, you know how they do. He was just like a puppy dog about to get whipped, you know. And he was just, oh, so humble. And he was just looking up at her. And she says, you know you're not supposed to. He's not in here, is he? Oh, he's in Awanas, okay. She says, you know you're not supposed to do that. Now, here's the way we do it. You know, two things you got to do to get rid of your misdeed. Confess and forsake. Okay. All right. What did you do? And he just stood there. She says, now, Daniel, what did you do? In the pocket he goes. Out come the cookies. She didn't even know about those. Okay. Caught him red-handed. Okay. He was just under such conviction. But, you know, the Lord has a way of just getting us caught, you know what I mean? Catching us in something. And I think God gives that parents that ability. I used to tell my older children that, you know, how'd you know? God told me. And I don't know that you can always describe it. You can see it on their faces sometimes. You can see it in their behavior. But sometimes you just sense it, and it's in a way that you can't describe. I'm sure there are some things that you see or hear, and it's a combination of very subtle things. I don't think there really is a sixth sense that parents have. But you kind of know when they've been up to something, don't you? And I think dads probably, maybe dads have a keener sense of that than moms. I think moms tend to be a little merciful sometimes, you know. Maybe. Maybe sometimes the other way around. God makes it so that one parent will bind up the wounds that the other one causes, you know. Don't you think? My wife tends to be very merciful at times, and I tend to be very hard, and then the other times we trade off, you know. But God lets us catch them. We've got to remember that we can keep the city, we can watch, we can do all that we want to and watch out for the misdeeds, but regardless of what kind of standards and convictions and character we have, it's God. It's God that does it. And we've got to commit them to the Lord. You gave them to the Lord when they were babies. You've got to keep giving them to the Lord as they grow up. Every phase brings something new. Wait until they get into your automobile. That will really be a trial of your faith. Just mark it down. Look, I wrote the furniture off a while back. I gave up on grass, but I was hoping to get my cars through this without having to worry about that. But I had to write that off too. John's folded the caravan up a couple of times, and Debbie folded the green car up a couple of times. And it's just going to take a few cars to get them raised, I guess. That's why you have insurance. Isn't that right? Teach them to wear their seatbelt and teach them to do right and tell them not to speed and do stupid things. And hope they don't get killed. Remember when they were on a tricycle? My wife used to say, oh, they'll skin their knees. And I said, yeah, they sure will. They'll heal. The skin is an amazing, amazing thing. You know? Mends itself. Really does. And it's going to take so many skin knees and so many skinned elbows and blisters and bee stings and all of the rest of it for them to grow up. And when they get bigger, those injuries will get more severe. And they come home with broken bones and casts and slings and all kinds of stuff. And none of my boys have really expressed an interest in a motorcycle. I had one of those. I had two of those, or how many? I don't know how many I had, but that must be an awful experience for parents to have to go through, thinking of their children out on a motorcycle, and nothing but a half inch of plastic, yeah, with a half inch of plastic between their brains and the pavement. Brother Kersup over here decided to get acquainted with a fella. Windshield first here a few years ago. You may recall that. He pulled out and the guy ran over him practically and threw him up over the... You sold that motorcycle shortly thereafter. It was total. I see. He did not replace it, I understand. He limped all over the platform for 2 years as a result of it. The steel pins in his legs and all the rest of it. That's going to happen. Folks, you can't... Mark Twain said, when they turn to be teenagers, you ought to nail them up in a pine box with a knot hole to breathe through. And then when they turn 17, you ought to plug up the knot hole. I've been tempted. Okay. I really have been tempted. And so have some of you, if you're honest about it. But that's not really the way to do it. You can't keep them from getting hurt, and you can't keep it. The Lord is in control of it, and we've got to commit them to the Lord. And we've just got to go through it with them. I was telling my wife one time. She was scared of flying, and she was scared of different things. And she says, oh, she said, I'm so worried about this and that and the other, whatever it was. And I said, well, honey, I said, think of the most safe circumstances you could possibly imagine. Saturday night at home, baking a cake in your own kitchen. She said, okay, all right. That's where she was when the fire happened, you know. Look, it's of the Lord. The horse is prepared against the day of battle, but safety is what? Of the Lord. That's right. And then it says, it is vain for you to rise up early, to sit up late, to eat the bread of sorrows. Now, that does not mean that you ought to sleep in. Okay? It says, if you are losing sleep, fretful, worrying, nail-biting, fidgety attitude over your kids, you're wasting your time. You commit them to the Lord. You commit them to the Lord. Don't you rise up early and sit up late and eat the bread of sorrows. You go ahead and rest. Get the rest you need to be the mother, dad that you ought to be. We're at the phase in our life now to where there are people still up when we go to bed. You know? You all been through that? Or do you all make them go to bed? I've tried, and sometimes we succeed, but now they're in college and they got homework. And I'm not going to stay up until they're done with their homework. I already been through all that. You know? I need some rest. Okay? You see? Turn the light out. Don't stay up late. Get up late or get up early and worry and fret thinking that you can change anything. Listen, you commit them to the Lord. Now, that doesn't mean ignore them. That doesn't mean neglect them. That doesn't mean deny your responsibility. That means you give them to the Lord and you be responsible for what you're supposed to be responsible for. Now remember, you can't do God's job in their life. You're God's representative, but you can't do what God alone can do. Don't ever forget that. Well, why? Well, because verse 3 says, "Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is His reward." Now, we focus on the fact that God has rewarded us as though we were something. And all the emphasis in that verse that we hear most of the time is on the fact that God has done us a favor by giving us kids. But the emphasis on that verse, when you look at the context, is on the fact that the kids do not belong to us. They are a reward to us. You see? Pastor Dixon said when he and Harriet got married, they wanted a quiver full. Now they just quiver. They got four of them. And they're all big ones. They've had more pounds of babies in four than we've had in five. But I'll tell you what. You know, sometimes, every now and then, they'll all be somewhere else except one or two. And the silence is deafening. And I think about some of you people that have 2.3 kids, you know, like the American society has. And I think, wonder what it would be like, you know. Now, there's not a one of them I wouldn't want. I could have probably put up two or three more, but I wasn't having them. The point is, when you have a lot of children, you've got a lot of work. Especially in this society. I have jokingly said it this way. If you got more kids than you got car windows, you got a big family. That's the truth. Because our society today is not designed for big families. Oh, well, you know, the pioneers, you know, they had 12 and 13. Yeah, and they threw them all the buckboard and that was all they had to worry about. But, you know, a vehicle in which you can get five kids safely does not come cheaply. Now, I was talking to one of our men a few years ago, and they just kept having children. They were still living in the same two-bedroom apartment that they had rented when he was a Bob Jones student. And they kept on having kids and kept on having kids. And I went to talk to him one day, and I said, "Paul, you got to find out what's causing this. You got to get you a new apartment." Now, I'm just being honest with you. You can't just keep having five, six, seven kids and stuff like that. And I've heard fellas that here's a guy that's got five children, getting ready to have a sixth one, going to the mission field. Going around telling churches about how people don't have a burden to send missionaries to the field. Now, I'm not suggesting to you that you should have fewer children. I'm just saying that you better realize if you have a lot of a big family, in this society today, you've got a big job on your hands. And if you have a lot of children, you are not going to be able necessarily to have some of the things that those who have one and two children have. But you're going to have something a whole lot better. You really are. You're going to have something a whole lot better. Because all that stuff that you could buy by not having a good family, you're not going to get to keep it anyway. And if you have those children and you teach them right and they get saved, you're going to have them forever. You're not going to have that furniture, that car, or even that house. But you'll have those children. And I thank the Lord. We have a noisy house. Anybody that's ever called at my house knows that's true. We have a noisy house. It's chaotic. People running to and fro. Our dog is nervous. I'm not kidding. He really is. That's my wife. Dog's nervous. Always looking around, you know. Somebody always running through back and forth. But I'm going to tell you, it's a blessing. It's a blessing. There's always somebody around to hug. Always somebody around to give a hug. Always somebody around to give a hug. You see? It's a blessing when you think about it. Children are an heritage of the Lord. That's God's blessing on our family. It really is. When my wife got out of the hospital, shortly after she was out of the hospital, we found that Daniel was on the way. And I thought, Lord, surely you have made a mistake. And I couldn't understand that. But now I know, now I understand what a joy he has been to us. Sing baby. He really was. He was a handful. Anybody that was here when he was a baby knows what I'm talking about. People used to look at him like, "What are you going to do about that boy?" You know, I used to have to call him down from the pulpit. Remember that? All the time. But now he's so precious. He's got such a tender heart. He's been talking about the ministry lately. I haven't put that word in his mind. But it'd be such a blessing. And Joseph, oh, what a little joy he is. You see, that's a blessing. Now, those are they belong to the Lord. They're not ours. They're not mine. They're not my wife's. They belong to God. And we've got them for a little while. Just a little while. And really, we don't have them as long as they're going to live with us. Because the last few years they live with you, you don't have a whole lot of influence on them. You just kind of, you know, feed them and encourage them a little bit. Next car I buy is going to be a taxi. Okay? No, I'm kidding. But that's the way I feel sometimes. I put a meter in that thing, you know. But that's what you have to do when they get up to be teenagers. Children are inheritors of the Lord. The fruit of the womb is His reward. And if you raise those kids to think that they belong to you and they exist for no other reason than for you to be happy and to obey you for your glory. Now, wait a minute. I think you ought to teach your kids to obey, but your kids are not your trophies. Yes, they are a reward. But we're not to set them up on a mantle and act like they belong to us and solve our own insecurities by pointing to our children. That's not what they're for. They are people. They have their own lives. They have their own will. They have their own character. They have their own nature. They have to be saved by making their own choice. And they really do. As arrows in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. You know what that means? That is so simple. The imagery is so simple. How long does the archer have an opportunity to influence the arrow? But a moment. And then the flight. And it strikes. Now, how will it fly and where will it strike? What does it depend on? How he holds it. How he aims it. And how he lets it go. I'm convinced that sometimes young people cut themselves off from the greatest source of help that they could possibly have for rearing their own children by rebelling against their parents because the parents didn't know how to let them go. And the parents didn't know how to let them go right, and so the only way they could get loose was to rebel, and then they went out not with the idea of, I'm going to have some children of my own, and I'm going to get some help from mom and dad because they've already done this. But then they have children of their own, and these children then become a way of saying, see, I'll show you. How many young people do you know today that are raising their children to spite their parents? Listen, that is especially a problem with fundamentalists whose parents are not fundamentalists. We want to produce perfect kids because we want to prove that our system is superior to their system. And you are looking at a guy that knows that from experience. When I got saved, one of the first things I want to do is straighten all my folks out and explain to them that now that I had the truth, that if they had had the truth, then it would have been a big help to me. And one of the things God's been teaching me in the last 15 or so years is that my folks did a whole lot better than I thought they did. Had a whole lot more going for them than I realized. Some of the things that I thought were their gravest mistakes were some of their greatest victories. I've said it before. There's a malady that affects the father of every teenage boy. It happens to the dad when the son is about 16 or 17. The father loses his mind. But when the boy gets to be about 25 or 26 or 27, somewhere along there, the dad starts to regain his sanity. And then the older that boy gets, the smarter that dad gets. And I think that same thing's true with moms. I've talked to some young ladies. If I were to call a name, you'd be surprised. A young lady used to be in our church. My wife and I have talked to that family. She's such a precious girl. Sweet little kids. Boy, she was a demon when she was a teenager. By her testimony and her parents. And her mom, she gave her mother more gray hair than you could possibly imagine. Now you know who her best friend is? Her mom. You see? Because now she's walking the path that her mom walked. And she's beginning to understand a few more things. So So parents, I think it's important for us to let them go in such a way that they can call on us if they need us. Sometimes we don't want to. We look at them when they get to be teenagers and we think, you know, you're not what I wanted you to be like when you were this age. I had bigger plans for you than this. I wanted more out of you than this. Now you're not going to go out here and disappoint me with this, are you? And the next thing you know, it's like hooking the ball, you know? Right before you let it go, you do something wrong, and the whole flight is affected. Pardon my golf illustration. No apologies. Okay. I played golf a few times this spring, purely evangelistic to be with the fellas and so on. But that's the truth. You make a little mistake. Look, when you shoot, if you move the gun right at the last minute, pull that trigger, and get the gun, what's going to happen to the bullet? As arrows in the hand of a mighty man, so are children of the youth. In other words, these children that he has raised up from his own youth, that he has grown up with, as he lets them go, they'll go where he has aimed them. Happy is the man that hath his quiver full of them. They shall not be ashamed. There's a blessing in having children. You know, I guess my sympathy for those of you that have decided, well, we're only going to have two children. My wife and I were into that stuff. Oh, listen, when we were in college, we wanted to go join the Peace Corps. Remember that? Back in the 60s? We didn't know what we wanted to do. We were all into that stuff and ecology and, you know, and population explosion. We're going to have two children, and that was it. We had Debbie, we had Johnny. We were done. Then I got saved. We committed our heart to the Lord. My wife went off to a ladies' retreat. Mrs. Hanford spoke. That same weekend in my Bible study, I believe it was this passage, God began to convict me that we should turn that area of our lives over to the Lord and say, Lord, whatever you want is what we want. Not what we want, but what you want. And my wife came home with fear and trembling, not knowing how to tell me that she had been convicted that we should turn this area of our lives over to the Lord. And so we did. I was due to get out of the service pretty soon. And Becky came along. We didn't have any insurance. Oh, it's a long story. I'm not going to go into all of it. Had an old saxophone. Boy, that saxophone's hard to come by. I had a saxophone from the time I was in the fifth grade. My freshman year at Cumberland College, the music building burned to the ground, and that saxophone was burned up in that fire. And I was able to get a Selmer Mark VI saxophone, which cost today over $2,000 as a result of the settlements in that fire. For very little money. And I played that thing. I made a living with it for a while. You may find that hard to believe. But I did. I say, why don't you play it now? You wouldn't want to hear what I played. That's why I'm trying to make a honor the Lord with your electric guitar. But at any rate, when I came off to Bob Jones, that was one of the few things that I had was of value. We didn't have any insurance for Becky. I think I mentioned this just the other day. And we had a hospital bill. And I sold that saxophone and put it on Becky's hospital bill. I'll tell you all about it in the book about the fire, about the connection is there. But Becky was the result. Our lives have been changed forever as a result of her. Our ministry, everything. And if we'd had our way, it wouldn't have been a Becky. But God had his way. You see what I'm saying? I'm not suggesting to you. I preached a message similar to this 10 years ago. And we knocked out every wall in the nursery for the next 5 years. I'm not trying to do that again. Don't misunderstand me. Don't misunderstand me. There's all kinds of jokes about, don't drink the water at Faith Baptist. And, you know, that's, remember those days? I'm not trying to do that again. But I'm trying to get you to understand something. I'm trying to get you to realize that there's a principle here. This belongs to God. Now, I'm not going to tell you what to do. But you, young couples, you make sure that you want the Lord's will. And you make sure that you're not going to have those children that you have, that God gives you, if He gives you children, so that you can brag to your parents about them, so that you can trot them out like a bunch of little partridges, and act like you're some big wheel, you see. But you make sure that you realize that those are eternal souls. That's one of the reasons I take marriage so seriously. When I counsel a couple for marriage, I perform 66 weddings, one divorce. I used to be able to say no divorces, and the couple that got divorced had absolutely no excuse for it. None whatsoever. No excuse. Never is. Well, what's the point? The point is, with a divorce rate of 50%, I think the reason that we've seen that kind of a response is because of how seriously we take it. You see, when a young couple gets married, eternal souls are going to come into existence as a result of that union. They're going to spend eternity somewhere. How would you like to think that you would have a child that would spend eternity in hell? Can you imagine such a thing? Now, they are born into our families, barbarians. They can't speak the language. They can't even feed themselves. They can't get up. They can't walk. They're just totally dependent upon us. And we got about 18 years to civilize them and turn them loose. That's not much time. It really isn't. We better be busy realizing first, except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain to build it. Except the Lord keeps us safe, the watchman waits in vain. They are the Lord's heritage. He gives them to us. They belong to Him. We are to raise them for His glory, like Hannah and Samuel. That's an important principle, isn't it? Remember that. That'll help you. Next time you lose your temper with them, you go in there and you want to beat on them in anger, who do they belong to? Next time you want to ignore them or neglect them, who committed them to your care? You see what I'm saying? Now you can stay up all night fretting over them, worry about them, become a nervous wreck, thinking that you are God in their lives. But you're not. You're a steward of those children. I'll pray for you that you'll learn this. If you'll agree to pray for me, that I'll learn it. Okay? Let's stand and be dismissed in prayer. Father, thank you. Thank you for our children. What a blessing. And yet, Lord, what a job. Lord, give us the strength that we need physically, spiritually, emotionally, to help them, to comfort them when they're sick and rejoice with them when they're happy, play with them when they're bored, discipline and teach them, help them to obey. Lord, help us to realize they are not ours, they are yours. All souls are yours. You've just committed them to us for a time. Lord, help us to live that way. In Jesus' name, amen.